Chapter 6. I arrived home feeling exhausted. Force of habit made me flick on the light in the hallway, even though the bulb had gone. We'd been meaning to replace it, but kept forgetting. I knew at once that Kathy wasn't there. It was too quiet, and she was incapable of quiet. She wasn't noisy, but her world was full of sound, talking on the phone, reciting lines, watching movies, singing, humming, listening to bands I'd never heard of. But now the flat was silent as a tomb. I called her name, force of habit again, or a guilty conscience, perhaps, wanting to make sure I was alone before I transgressed. Kathy? No reply. I fumbled my way through the dark into the living room. I turned on the light. The room leapt out at me in the way new furniture always does until you've had the time to get used to it. New chairs, new cushions, new colours, reds and yellows, where there had once been black and white. A vase of pink lilies, Kathy's favourite flowers, was on the table. Their strong, musky scent made the air thick and hard to breathe. What time was it? 8:30. Where was she? Rehearsal? She was in a new production of Othello at the RSC, and it wasn't going particularly well. Endless rehearsals had been taking their toll. She seemed visibly tired, pale, thinner than usual, fighting a cold. I'm so fucking sick all the time, she said. I'm exhausted. And it was true. She'd come back from rehearsal later and later each night, looking terrible. She'd yawn and stumble straight into bed, so she probably wouldn't be home for a couple of hours at the earliest. I decided to risk it. I took the jar of weed from its hiding place and started rolling a joint. I'd been smoking marijuana since university. I encountered it during my first term, alone and friendless at a fresher party, too paralysed with fear to initiate a conversation with any of the good-looking and confident young people around me. I was planning my escape when the girl standing next to me offered me something. I thought it was a cigarette until I smelled the spicy, pungent, curling black smoke. Too shy to refuse, I accepted it and brought the joint to my lips. It was badly rolled and coming unstuck, unravelling at the end. The tip was wet and stained red from her lipstick. It tasted different from a cigarette. It was richer, rawer, more exotic. I swallowed down the thick smoke and tried not to cough. Initially, all I felt was a little light on my feet. Like sex, clearly more fuss was made over marijuana than it merited. And then, a minute or so later, something happened. Something incredible. It was like being drenched in an enormous wave of well-being. I felt safe, relaxed, totally at ease, silly and unself-conscious. And that was it. It didn't take long before I was smoking weed every day. It became my best friend, my inspiration, my solace, an endless ritual of rolling, licking, lighting. I would get stoned just from the rustling of rolling papers and the anticipation of the warm, intoxicating high. All kinds of theories have been put forward about the origins of addiction. It could be genetic, it could be chemical, it could be psychological. But marijuana was doing something much more than soothing me. Crucially, it altered the way I experienced my emotions. It cradled me and held me safe like a well-loved child. In other words, it contained me. It was the psychoanalyst W.R. Bion who came up with the term containment to describe a mother's ability to manage her baby's pain. Remember, babyhood is not a time of bliss, it's one of terror. As babies, we are trapped in a strange, alien world, unable to see properly, and in a constant state of surprise at our bodies, alarmed by hunger and wind and bowel movements, overwhelmed by our feelings. We are quite literally under attack. We need our mother to soothe our distress and make sense of our experience. As she does so, we slowly learn how to manage our physical and emotional states on our own. But our ability to contain ourselves directly depends on our mother's ability to contain us. If she had never experienced containment by her own mother, how could she teach us what she did not know? Someone who has never learned to contain himself is plagued by anxious feelings for the rest of his life. feelings that Bjorn aptly titled nameless dread, and such a person endlessly seeks this unquenchable containment from external sources. He needs a drink or a joint to take the edge off this endless anxiety, hence my addiction to marijuana. I talked a lot about marijuana in therapy. I wrestled with the idea of giving up and wondered why the prospect scared me so much. Ruth said that enforcement and constraint never produced anything good, and that rather than force myself to live without weed, a better starting place might be to acknowledge that I was now dependent on it and unwilling or unable to abandon it. Whatever marijuana did for me was still working, Ruth argued, until the day it would outlive its usefulness, when I would probably relinquish it with ease. And Ruth was right. When I met Kathy and fell in love, marijuana faded into the background. I was naturally high on love, with no need to artificially induce a good mood. It helped that Kathy didn't smoke it. Stoners, in her opinion, were weak-willed and lazy and lived in slow motion. You pricked them and 6 days later they'd say, ouch. I stopped smoking weed the day Kathy moved into my flat, and, as Ruth had predicted, once I was secure and happy, the habit fell away from me quite naturally, like dry caked mud from a boot. I might never have smoked it again if we hadn't gone to a leaving party for Kathy's friend, Nicole, who was moving to New York. Kathy was monopolized by all her actor friends, and I found myself alone. A short, stubby man wearing a pair of neon pink glasses nudged me and said, "Want some?" He was offering me a joint. I was about to refuse when something stopped me. I'm not sure what. A momentary whim? Or an unconscious attack on Kathy for forcing me to come to this horrible party and then abandoning me? I looked around and she was nowhere to be seen. Fuck it, I thought. I brought the joint to my lips and inhaled. And just like that, I was back where I had started, as if there had been no break. My addiction had been waiting for me patiently all this time, like a faithful dog. I didn't tell Kathy what I had done, and I put it out of my mind. In fact, I was waiting for an opportunity, and 6 weeks later it presented itself. Kathy went to New York for a week to visit Nicole. Without Kathy's influence, lonely and bored, I gave in to temptation. I didn't have a dealer anymore, so I did what I had done as a student and made my way to Camden Market. As I left the station, I could smell marijuana in the air, mingled with the scent of incense and food stalls frying onions. I walked over to the bridge by Camden Lock. I stood there awkwardly, pushed and nudged by an endless stream of tourists and teenagers trudging back and forth across the bridge. I scanned the crowd. There was no sign of any of the dealers who used to line the bridge, calling out to you as you passed. I spotted a couple of police officers, unmissable in their bright yellow jackets, patrolling the crowd. They walked away from the bridge, towards the station, and then I heard a low voice by my side. "Want some green, mate?" I looked down and there was a very small man. I thought he was a child at first, he was so slight and slender. But his face was a roadmap of rugged terrain, lined and crossed, like a boy prematurely aged. He was missing his two front teeth, giving his words a slight whistle. "Green," he repeated. I nodded. He jerked his head at me to follow him. He slipped through the crowd and went round the corner and along a back street. He entered an old pub and I followed. It was deserted inside, dingy and tattered, and stank of vomit and old cigarette smoke. "Gi's a beer," he said, hovering at the bar. He was scarcely tall enough to see over it. I begrudgingly bought him half a pint. He took it to a table in the corner. I sat opposite him. He looked around furtively, then reached under the table and slipped me a small package wrapped in cellophane. I gave him some cash. I went home and I opened the package, half expecting to have been ripped off, but a familiar, pungent smell of weed drifted to my nose. I saw the little green buds streaked with gold. My heart raced as though I had encountered a long-lost friend, which I suppose I had. From then on, I would get high occasionally, whenever I found myself alone in the flat for a few hours, when I was sure Kathy would not be coming back any time soon. And that night, when I came home, tired and frustrated, and found Kathy out at rehearsal, I quickly rolled a joint. I smoked it out of the bathroom window. But I smoked too much, too fast. It hit me hard, like a punch between the eyes. I was so stoned, even walking felt difficult, like wading through treacle. I went through my usual sanitizing ritual, air freshener, brushing my teeth, having a shower, and I carefully maneuvered myself to the living room. I sank onto the sofa. I looked for the TV remote, but I couldn't see it, and then I located it, peeking out from behind Kathy's open laptop on the coffee table. I reached for it, but was so stoned I knocked over the laptop in the process. I propped the laptop up again, and the screen came to life. It was logged into her email account. For some reason, I kept staring at it. I was transfixed. Her inbox stared at me like a gaping hole. I couldn't look away. All kinds of things jumped out before I knew what I was reading, words like sexy and fuck in the email headings, and repeated emails from Bad Boy 22. If only I'd stopped there. If only I'd got up and walked away. But I didn't. I clicked on the most recent email and opened it. Subject, re Little Miss Fuck, from Caterama 1 to Bad Boy 22. I'm on the bus, so horny for you. I can smell you on me. I feel like a slut. KXX, sent from my iPhone. Subject, re Little Miss Fuck, from Bad Boy 22 to Caterama 1. You are a slut, lol. See you later, after rehearsal. Subject, re Little Miss Fuck, from Bad Boy 22 to Caterama 1. Okay, we'll see what time I can get away, I'll text you. Subject, re Little Miss Fuck, from Caterama 1 to Bad Boy 22. Okay, 839XX, sent from my iPhone. I pulled the laptop from the table. I sat with it on my lap, staring at it. I don't know how long I sat like that for. 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, maybe longer. Time seemed to slow to a crawl. I tried to process what I had just seen. But I was still so stoned, I wasn't sure what I had seen. Was it real or some kind of misunderstanding, some joke I wasn't getting because I was so high? I forced myself to read another email and another. I ended up going through all of Kathy's emails to Bad Boy 22. Some were sexual, obscene even. Others were longer, more confessional, emotional, and she sounded drunk. Perhaps they were written late at night after I'd gone to bed. I pictured myself in the bedroom, asleep, while Kathy was out here, writing intimate messages to this stranger. This stranger she was fucking. Time caught up with itself with a jolt. Suddenly I was no longer stoned. I was horribly, painfully sober. There was a wrenching pain in my stomach. I threw aside the laptop. I ran into the bathroom. I fell to my knees in front of the toilet and threw up. Chapter 7. This feels rather different from last time, I said. No response. Alicia sat opposite me in the chair, head turned slightly towards the window. She sat perfectly still, her spine rigid and straight. She looked like a cellist or a soldier. I'm thinking of how the last session ended, when you physically attacked me and had to be restrained. No response. I hesitated. I wonder if you did it as some kind of test, to see what I'm made of. I think it's important that you know I'm not easily intimidated. I can take whatever you throw at me. Alicia looked out of the window at the grey sky beyond the bars. I waited a moment and went on. There's something I need to tell you, Alicia. That I'm on your side. Hopefully one day you'll believe that. Of course, it takes time to build trust. My old therapist used to say intimacy requires the repeated experience of being responded to, and that doesn't happen overnight. Alicia stared at me, unblinking, with an inscrutable gaze. The minutes passed. It felt more like an endurance test than a therapy session. I wasn't making progress in any direction, it seemed. Perhaps it was all hopeless. Christian had been right to point out that rats desert sinking ships. What the hell was I doing clambering upon this wreck, lashing myself to the mast, preparing to drown? The answer, of course, was sitting in front of me. As Diomedes put it, Alicia was a silent siren luring me to my doom. I felt a sudden desperation. I wanted to scream at her, say something, anything, just talk. But I didn't say that. Instead, I broke with therapeutic tradition. I stopped treading softly and got directly to the point. I'd like to talk about your silence, about what it means, what it feels like, and specifically why you stopped talking. Alicia didn't look at me. Was she even listening? As I sit here with you, a picture keeps coming into my mind, an image of someone biting their fist, holding back a yell, swallowing a scream. I remember when I first started therapy, I found it very hard to cry. I feared I'd be carried away by the flood, overwhelmed. Perhaps that's what it feels like for you. That's why it's important to take your time to feel safe and trust that you won't be alone in this flood, that I'm treading water here with you. Silence. I think of myself as a relational therapist, I said. Do you know what that means? Silence. It means I think Freud was wrong about a couple of things. I don't believe a therapist can ever really be a blank slate, as he intended. We leak all kinds of information about ourselves unintentionally, by the colour of my socks, or how I sit, or the way I talk. Just by sitting here with you, I reveal a great deal about myself. Despite my best efforts at invisibility, I'm showing you who I am. Alicia looked up. She stared at me, her chin slightly tilted. Was there a challenge in that look? At last I had her attention. I shifted in my seat. The point is, what can we do about this? We can ignore it and deny it and pretend this therapy is all about you, or we can acknowledge that this is a two-way street and work with that, and then we can really start to get somewhere. I held up my hand. I nodded at my wedding ring. This ring tells you something, doesn't it? Alicia's eyes ever so slowly moved in the direction of the ring. It tells you I'm a married man. It tells you I have a wife. We've been married for nearly 9 years. No response, and yet she kept staring at the ring. You were married for about 7 years, weren't you? No reply. I love my wife very much. Did you love your husband? Alicia's eyes moved. They darted up to my face. We stared at each other. Love includes all kinds of feelings, doesn't it? Good and bad. I love my wife. Her name is Kathy, but sometimes I get angry with her. Sometimes I hate her. Alicia kept staring at me. I felt like a rabbit in the headlights, frozen, unable to look away or move. The attack alarm was on the table, within reach. I made a concerted effort not to look at it. I knew I shouldn't keep talking, that I should shut up, but I couldn't stop myself. I went on compulsively. And when I say I hate her, I don't mean all of me hates her, just a part of me hates. It's about holding on to both parts at the same time. Part of you loved Gabriel, part of you hated him. Alicia shook her head. No, a brief movement, but definite. Finally, a response. I felt a sudden thrill. I should have stopped there, but I didn't. Part of you hated him, I said again, more firmly. Another shake of the head. Her eyes burned through me. She's getting angry, I thought. It's true, Alicia, or you wouldn't have killed him. Alicia suddenly jumped up. I thought she was about to leap on me, my body tensed in anticipation, but instead she turned and marched to the door. She hammered on it with her fists. There was the sound of a key turning, and Yuri threw open the door. He looked relieved not to find Alicia strangling me on the floor. She pushed past him and ran into the corridor.
"Steady on, slow down, honey," he said.
He glanced back at me.
"Everything okay? What happened?"
I didn't reply. Yuri gave me a funny look and left. I was alone. Idiot, I thought to myself. You idiot, what was I doing? I'd pushed her too far, too hard, too soon. It was horribly unprofessional, not to mention totally fucking inept. It revealed far more about my state of mind than hers. But that's what Alicia did for you. Her silence was like a mirror, reflecting yourself back at you. And it was often an ugly sight. Chapter 8. You don't need to be a psychotherapist to suspect that Kathy left her laptop open because, on an unconscious level at least, she wanted me to find out about her infidelity. Well, now I had found out. Now I knew. I hadn't spoken to her since the other night, feigning sleep when she got back and leaving the flat in the morning before she woke up. I was avoiding her, avoiding myself. I was in a state of shock. I knew I had to take a look at myself or risk losing myself. Get a grip, I muttered under my breath as I rolled a joint. I smoked it out of the window, and then, suitably stoned, I poured a glass of wine in the kitchen. The glass slipped out of my grasp as I picked it up. I tried to catch it as it fell, but only succeeded in thrusting my hand into a shard of glass as it smashed on the table, slicing a chunk of flesh from my finger. Suddenly, there was blood everywhere. Blood trickling down my arm, blood on broken glass, blood mingling with white wine on the table. I struggled to tear off some kitchen paper and bound my finger tight to stem the flow. I held my hand above my head, watching blood stream down my arm in tiny, diverging rivulets, mimicking the pattern of veins beneath my skin. I thought of Kathy. It was Kathy I would reach for in a moment of crisis, when I needed sympathy or reassurance or someone to kiss it better. I wanted her to look after me. I thought about calling her, but even as I had this thought, I imagined a door closing fast, slamming shut, locking her out of reach. Kathy was gone. I had lost her. I wanted to cry, but couldn't. I was blocked up inside, packed with mud and shit. Fuck, I kept repeating to myself. Fuck! I became conscious of the clock ticking. It seemed louder now somehow. I tried to focus on it and anchor my spinning thoughts. Tick, tick, tick. But the chorus of voices in my head grew louder and wouldn't be silenced. Of course, I thought, she was bound to be unfaithful. This had to happen. It was inevitable. I was never good enough for her. I was useless, ugly, worthless, nothing. She was bound to tire of me eventually. I didn't deserve her. I didn't deserve anything. It went on and on, one horrible thought punching me after another. How little I knew her. Those emails demonstrated I'd been living with a stranger, and now I saw the truth. Kathy hadn't saved me. She wasn't capable of saving anyone. She was no heroine to be admired, just a frightened, fucked-up girl, a cheating liar. This whole mythology of us that I had built up, our hopes and dreams, likes and dislikes, our plans for the future, a life that had seemed so secure, so sturdy, now collapsed in a matter of seconds, like a house of cards in a gust of wind. My mind went to that cold room at college all those years ago, tearing open packets of paracetamol with clumsy, numb fingers. The same numbness overtook me now, that same desire to curl up and die. I thought of my mother. Could I call her, turn to her in my moment of desperation and need? I imagined her answering the phone, her voice shaky. Just how shaky depended on my father's mood and if she'd been drinking. She might listen sympathetically to me, but her mind would be elsewhere, one eye on my dad and his temper. How could she help me? How can one drowning rat save another? I had to get out. I couldn't breathe in here, in this flat with these stinking lilies. I needed some air. I needed to breathe. I left the flat. I dug my hands in my pockets and kept my head low. I pounded the streets, walking fast, going nowhere. In my mind, I kept going back over our relationship, scene by scene, remembering it, examining it, turning it over, looking for clues. I remembered unresolved fights, unexplained absences, and frequent lateness. But I also remembered small acts of kindness, affectionate notes she'd leave for me in unexpected places, moments of sweetness and apparently genuine love. How was this possible? Had she been acting the whole time? Had she ever loved me? I remembered the flicker of doubt I'd had upon meeting her friends. They were all actors, loud, narcissistic, preening, endlessly talking about themselves and people I didn't know. Suddenly I was transported back to school, hovering alone on the fringes of the playground, watching the other kids play. I convinced myself Kathy wasn't like them at all, but clearly she was. If I had encountered them that first night at the bar when I met her, would they have put me off her? I doubt it. Nothing could have prevented our union. From the moment I saw Kathy, my fate was written. What should I do? Confront her, of course. Tell her everything I had seen. She'd react by denying it. Then, seeing it was hopeless, she would admit the truth and prostrate herself, stricken with remorse. She'd beg my forgiveness, wouldn't she? What if she didn't? What if she scorned me? What if she laughed and turned on her heel and left? What then? Between the two of us, I had most to lose, that was obvious. Kathy would survive. She was fond of saying she was tough as nails. She'd pick herself up, dust herself off, and forget all about me. But I wouldn't forget about her. How could I? Without Kathy, I'd return to that empty, solitary existence I had endured before. I'd never meet anyone like her again, never have that same connection or experience that depth of feeling for another human being. She was the love of my life. She was my life, and I wasn't ready to give her up. Not yet. Even though she had betrayed me, I still loved her. Perhaps I was crazy after all. A solitary bird shrieked above my head, startling me. I stopped and looked around. I'd gone much further than I thought. It was with some shock that I saw where my feet had carried me. I had walked to within a couple of streets of Ruth's front door. Without intending to, I had unconsciously made my way to my old therapist in a time of trouble, as I had done so many times in the past. It was a testament to how upset I was that I considered going up to her door and ringing the bell and asking for help. And why not? I thought suddenly. Yes, it was unprofessional and highly improper conduct, but I was desperate and I needed help. And before I knew it, I was standing in front of Ruth's green door, watching my hand reach up to the buzzer and press it. It took her a few moments to answer it. A light went on in the hallway, and then she opened the door, keeping the chain on. Ruth peered out through the crack. She looked older. She must be in her 80s now, smaller, frailer than I remembered, and slightly stooped. She was wearing a grey cardigan over a pale pink nightgown.
"Hello?"
she said nervously.
"Who's there?"
"Hello, Ruth," I said, stepping into the light. She recognized me and gave me a look of surprise.
"Theo, what on earth?"
Her eyes went from my face to the clumsy, improvised bandage around my finger with blood seeping through it.
"Are you all right?"
"Not really. May I come in? I need to talk to you." There was no hesitation on Ruth's part, only a look of concern. She nodded.
"Of course, come in."
She undid the chain and opened the door. I stepped inside. Chapter 9.
"Would you like a cup of tea?"
Ruth asked as she showed me into the living room. The room was as it always had been, as I'd always remembered it. The rug, the heavy drapes, the silver clock ticking on the mantel, the armchair, the faded blue couch. I felt instantly reassured. "To be honest," I said, "I could do with something stronger." Ruth shot me a brief, piercing glance, but didn't comment, nor did she refuse, as I half expected. She poured me a glass of sherry and handed it to me. I sat on the couch. Force of habit made me sit where I always had done for therapy, on the far left side, resting my arm on the armrest. The fabric underneath my fingertips was worn thin by the anxious rubbing of many patients, myself included. I took a sip of sherry. It was warm, sweet, and a little sickly, but I drank it down, conscious of Ruth watching me the whole time. Her gaze was obvious, but not heavy or uncomfortable. In 20 years, Ruth had never managed to make me feel uncomfortable. I didn't speak again until I had finished the sherry. It feels odd to be sitting here with a glass in my hand. I know you're not in the habit of offering drinks to your patients.
You're not my patient anymore, just a friend. And by the look of you, she added gently, you need a friend right now.
Do I look that bad?
You do, I'm afraid. And it must be serious, or you wouldn't come over uninvited like this. Certainly not at 10 o'clock at night.
You're right. I felt I had no choice.
What is it, Theo? What's the matter?
I don't know how to tell you. I don't know where to start.
How about the beginning?
I nodded. I took a breath and began. I told her about everything that had happened. I told her about starting marijuana again, about how I'd been smoking it secretly and how it led to my discovering Kathy's emails and her affair. I spoke quickly, breathlessly, wanting to get it off my chest. I felt like I was in confession. Ruth listened without interruption until I had finished. It was hard to read her expression. Finally, she said,
I am very sorry this has happened, Theo. I know how much Kathy means to you, how much you love her.
Yes, I love. I stopped, unable to say her name. There was a tremor in my voice. Ruth picked up on it and edged the box of tissues towards me. I used to get angry when she would do that in our sessions. I'd accuse her of trying to make me cry. She would generally succeed, but not tonight. Tonight my tears were frozen, a reservoir of ice. I had been seeing Ruth for a long time before I met Kathy, and I continued therapy for the first 3 years of our relationship. I remember the advice Ruth gave me when Kathy and I first got together.
Choosing a lover is a lot like choosing a therapist, Ruth had said. We need to ask ourselves, is this someone who will be honest with me, listen to criticism, admit making mistakes, and not promise the impossible?
I told all this to Kathy at the time, and she suggested we make a pact. We swore never to lie to each other, never pretend, always be truthful. What happened? I said. What went wrong? Ruth hesitated before she spoke. What she said surprised me.
I suspect you know the answer to that, if you would just admit it to yourself.
I don't know, I said, shaking my head. I don't. I fell into indignant silence, and yet I had a sudden image in my mind of Kathy writing all those emails, and how passionate they were, how charged, as if she were getting high from the act of writing them, from the secret, clandestine nature of her relationship with this man. She enjoyed lying and sneaking around. It was like acting, but off stage. I think she's bored, I said eventually.
What makes you say that?
Because she needs excitement, drama. She always has. She's been complaining for a while, I suppose, that we don't have any fun anymore, that I'm always stressed, that I work too hard. We fought about it recently. She kept using the word fireworks.
Fireworks?
As in, there aren't any between us.
Ah, I see. Ruth nodded. We've talked about this before, haven't we?
About fireworks?
About love. About how we often mistake love for fireworks? For drama and dysfunction? But real love is very quiet, very still. It's boring if seen from the perspective of high drama. Love is deep and calm and constant. I imagine you do give Kathy love in the true sense of the word. Whether or not she is capable of giving it back to you is another question.
I stared at the box of tissues on the table in front of me. I didn't like where Ruth was going. I tried to deflect her. There are faults on both sides, I said. I lied to her too, about the weed. Ruth smiled sadly.
I don't know if persistent sexual and emotional betrayal with another human being is on the same level as getting stoned every now and then. I think it points to a very different kind of individual. Someone who is able to lie repeatedly and lie well, who can betray their partner without feeling any remorse.
You don't know that, I said, sounding as pathetic as I felt. She might feel terrible. But even as I said that, I didn't believe it. Neither did Ruth.
I don't think so, she said. I think her behavior suggests she is quite damaged, lacking in empathy and integrity and just plain kindness. All the qualities you brim with.
I shook my head. That's not true.
It is true, Theo.
She hesitated.
Don't you think perhaps you've been here before?
With Kathy? Ruth shook her head.
I don't mean that. I mean with your parents, when you were younger. If there's a childhood dynamic here, you might be replaying.
No, I said, suddenly feeling irritated. What's happening with Kathy has got nothing to do with my childhood.
Oh, really? Ruth sounded disbelieving. Trying to please someone unpredictable, someone emotionally unavailable, uncaring, unkind, trying to keep them happy, win their love. Is this not an old story, Theo, a familiar story?
I clenched my fist and didn't speak. Ruth went on, hesitantly.
I know how sad you feel, but I want you to consider the possibility that you felt this sadness long before you met Kathy. It's a sadness you've been carrying around for many years. You know, Theo, one of the hardest things to admit is that we weren't loved when we needed it most. It's a terrible feeling, the pain of not being loved.
She was right, of course. I had been groping for the right words to express that murky feeling of betrayal inside, the horrible, hollow ache, and to hear Ruth say it, the pain of not being loved, I saw how it pervaded my entire consciousness and was at once the story of my past, present, and future. This wasn't just about Kathy, it was about my father and my childhood feelings of abandonment, my grief for everything I never had and in my heart still believed I never would have. And Ruth was saying that was why I had chosen Kathy. What better way for me to prove that my father was correct? That I'm worthless and unlovable than by pursuing someone who will never love me. I buried my head in my hands. So all this was inevitable, that's what you're saying. I set myself up for this. It's fucking hopeless.
It's not hopeless. You're not a boy at the mercy of your father anymore. You're a grown man now, and you have a choice. Use this as another confirmation of how unworthy you are, or break with the past. Free yourself from endlessly repeating it.
How do I do that? You think I should leave her?
I think it's a very difficult situation.
But you think I should leave, don't you?
You've come too far and worked too hard to return to a life of dishonesty and denial and emotional abuse. You deserve someone who treats you better, much better.
Just say it, Ruth, say it. You think I should leave? Ruth looked me in the eyes. She held my gaze.
I think you must leave, she said. And I'm not saying this as your old therapist, but as your old friend. I don't think you could go back even if you wanted to. It might last a little while, perhaps, but in a few months something else will happen and you'll end up back here on this couch. Be honest with yourself, Theo. About Kathy and this situation, and everything built on lies and untruths will fall away from you. Remember, love that doesn't include honesty doesn't deserve to be called love.
I sighed, deflated, depressed, and very tired. Thank you, Ruth, for your honesty. It means a lot. Ruth gave me a hug at the door as I left. She'd never done that before. She was fragile in my arms, her bones so delicate. I breathed in her faint flowery scent and the wool of her cardigan, and again I felt like crying. But I didn't, or couldn't, cry. Instead, I walked away and didn't look back. I caught a bus back home. I sat by the window, staring out, thinking of Kathy, of her white skin and those beautiful green eyes. I was filled with such a longing for the sweet taste of her lips, her softness. But Ruth was right. Love that doesn't include honesty doesn't deserve to be called love. I had to go home and confront Kathy. I had to leave her. Chapter 10. Kathy was there when I got home. She was sitting on the couch, texting. "Where were you?" she asked without looking up. "Just a walk. How was rehearsal? All right? Tiring?" I watched her texting, wondering who she was writing to. I knew this was my moment to speak. "I know you're having an affair. I want a divorce." I opened my mouth to say it, but I found I was mute. And before I could recover my voice, Kathy beat me to it. She stopped texting and put down her phone. "Theo, we need to talk." "What about? Don't you have something to tell me?" There was a stern note in her voice. I avoided looking at her, in case she could read my thoughts. I felt ashamed and furtive, as if I were the one with the guilty secret. And I was, as far as she was concerned. Kathy reached behind the sofa and picked something up, and at once my heart sank. She was holding the small jar where I kept the grass. I'd forgotten to hide it back in the spare room after I'd cut my finger. "What's this?" she asked, holding it up. "It's weed." "I'm aware of that. What's it doing here?" "I bought some. I fancied it." "Fancied what? Getting high? Are you serious?" I shrugged, evading her eye like a naughty child. "What the fuck? I mean, Jesus." Kathy shook her head, outraged. "Sometimes I think I don't know you at all." I wanted to hit her. I wanted to leap on her and beat her with my fists. I wanted to smash up the room, break the furniture against the walls. I wanted to weep and howl and bury myself in her arms. I did none of this. "Let's go to bed," I said, and walked out. We went to bed in silence. I lay in the dark next to her. I lay awake for hours, feeling the heat from her body, staring at her while she slept. "Why didn't you come to me?" I wanted to say. "Why didn't you talk to me? I was your best friend. If you had just said one word, we could have worked through it. Why didn't you talk to me? I'm here, I'm right here." I wanted to reach out and pull her close. I wanted to hold her, but I couldn't. Kathy had gone. The person I loved so much had disappeared forever, leaving this stranger in her place. A sob rose at the back of my throat. Finally, the tears came, streaming down my cheeks. Silently, in the darkness, I wept. The next morning, we got up and performed the usual routine. She went into the bathroom while I made coffee. I handed her a cup when she came into the kitchen. "You were making strange sounds in the night," she said. "You were talking in your sleep." "What did I say?" "I don't know, nothing. Didn't make sense. Probably because you were so stoned." She gave me a withering look and glanced at her watch. "I have to go, I'll be late." Kathy finished her coffee and placed the cup in the sink. She gave me a quick kiss on the cheek. The touch of her lips almost made me flinch. After she left, I had a shower. I turned up the temperature until it was almost scalding. The hot water lashed against my face as I wept, burning away messy, babyish tears. As I dried myself afterwards, I caught a glimpse of my reflection in the mirror. I was shocked. I was ashen, shrunken, aged 30 years overnight. I was old, exhausted, my youth evaporated. I made a decision, there and then. Leaving Kathy would be like tearing off a limb. I simply wasn't prepared to mutilate myself like that. No matter what Ruth said, Ruth wasn't infallible. Kathy was not my father. I wasn't condemned to repeat the past. I could change the future. Kathy and I were happy before. We could be again. One day she might confess it all to me, tell me about it, and I would forgive her. We would work through this. I would not let Kathy go. Instead, I would say nothing. I would pretend I had never read those emails. And somehow I'd forget. I'd bury it. I had no choice but to go on. I refused to give in to this. I refused to break down and fall apart. After all, I wasn't just responsible for myself. What about the patients in my care? Certain people depended on me. I couldn't let them down. Chapter 11. I'm looking for Elif, I said. Any idea where I can find her? Yuri gave me a curious look. Any reason you want her? Just to say a quick hello. I want to meet all the patients, let them know who I am, that I'm here. Yuri looked doubtful. Right. Well, don't take it personally if she's not very receptive. He glanced at the clock on the wall. It's after 1:30, so she's just out of art therapy. Your best bet is the recreation room. Thanks. The recreation area was a large circular room furnished with battered couches, low tables, a bookcase full of tattered books no one wanted to read. It smelled of stale tea and old cigarette smoke that had stained the furnishings. A couple of patients were playing backgammon in a corner. Elif was alone at the pool table. I approached with a smile. Hello, Elif. She looked up with scared, mistrustful eyes. What? Don't worry, there's nothing wrong, I just want a quick word. You ain't my doctor, I already got one. I'm not a doctor, I'm a psychotherapist. Elif grunted contemptuously. I got one of them too. I smiled, secretly relieved she was Indira's patient and not mine. Up close, Elif was even more intimidating. It wasn't just her massive size, but also the rage etched deep into her face. A permanent scowl and angry black eyes, eyes that were quite clearly disturbed. She stank of sweat and the rollies she was always smoking that had left her fingertips stained black and her nails and teeth a dark yellow. I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions, I said, if that's okay, about Alicia. Elif scowled and banged the cue on the table. She started setting up the balls for another game, then she stopped. She just stood there, looking distracted, in silence. Elif? She didn't respond. I could tell from her expression what was wrong. Are you hearing voices, Elif? A suspicious glance, a shrug. What are they saying? You ain't safe, telling me to watch out? I see. Quite right. You don't know me, so it's sensible not to trust me. Not yet. Perhaps over time that will change. Elif gave me a look that suggested she doubted it. I nodded at the pool table. Fancy a game? Nope. Why not? She shrugged. Are the cues broke? They ain't replaced it yet. But I can share your cue, can't I? The cue was resting on the table. I went to touch it and she yanked it out of reach. It's my fucking cue, get your own! I stepped back, unnerved by the ferocity of her reaction. She played a shot with considerable force. I watched her play for a moment, then I tried again. I was wondering if you could tell me about something that happened when Alicia was first admitted to the Grove. Do you remember? Elif shook her head. I went on. I read in her file that you had an altercation in the canteen. You were on the receiving end of an attack. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she tried to kill me, innit? Tried to cut my fucking throat. According to the handover notes, a nurse saw you whisper something to Alicia before the attack. I was wondering what it was. No. Elif shook her head furiously. I didn't say nothing. I'm not trying to suggest you provoked her. I'm just curious. What was it? I asked her something, so fucking what? What did you ask? I asked if he deserved it. Who? Him, a bloke. Elif smiled, although it wasn't really a smile, more a misshapen grimace. You mean her husband? I hesitated, unsure if I understood. You asked Alicia if her husband deserved to be killed. Alif nodded and played a shot.
And I asked what he looked like when she shot him and his skull was broke and his brains all spilled out.
She laughed. I felt a sudden wave of disgust, similar to the feelings I imagined Alif had provoked in Alicia. Alif made you feel repulsion and hatred. That was her pathology. That was how her mother had made her feel as a very small child, hateful and repulsive. And so Alif unconsciously provoked you to hate her, and mostly she succeeded. And how are things now? I asked. Are you and Alicia on good terms?
Oh, yeah, mate, we're real tight, best mates.
Alif laughed again. Before I could respond, I felt my phone vibrating in my pocket. I checked it. I didn't recognize the number. I should answer this. Thank you. You've been very helpful. Alif muttered something unintelligible and went back to her game. I walked into the corridor and answered the phone.
Hello,
I said.
Is that Theo Faber?
Speaking. Who's this?
Max Berenson here, returning your call.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thanks for calling me back. I was wondering if we could have a conversation about Alicia.
Why? What's happened? Is something wrong?
No, I mean, not exactly. I'm treating her, and I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about her, whenever's convenient.
I don't suppose we could do it on the phone. I'm rather busy.
I'd rather talk in person, if possible. Max Berenson sighed and mumbled as he spoke to someone off the phone, and then...
Tomorrow evening, 7 o'clock, my office.
I was about to ask for the address, but he hung up.
Chapter 12.
Max Berenson's receptionist had a bad cold. She reached for a tissue, blew her nose, and gestured at me to wait.
He's on the phone, he'll be out in a minute.
I nodded and took a seat in the waiting area. A few uncomfortable upright chairs, a coffee table with a stack of out-of-date magazines. All waiting rooms looked alike, I thought. I could just as easily have been waiting to see a doctor or a funeral director as a solicitor. The door across the hallway opened. Max Berenson appeared and beckoned me over. He disappeared back into his office. I got up and followed him inside. I expected the worst, given his gruff manner on the phone, but to my surprise, he began with an apology.
"I'm sorry I was abrupt when we spoke," he said.
"It's been a long week, and I'm a bit under the weather. Won't you sit down?" I sat on the chair on the other side of the desk.
"Thanks,"
I said.
"And thank you for agreeing to see me."
"Well, I wasn't sure I should at first. I thought you were a journalist trying to get me to talk about Alicia, but then I called the Grove and checked you worked there."
"I see. Does that happen a lot? Journalists, I mean?"
"Not recently. It used to. I learned to be on my guard." He was about to say something else, but a sneeze overtook him. He reached for a box of tissues.
"Sorry, I have the family cold."
He blew his nose. I glanced at him more closely. Unlike his younger brother, Max Berenson was not an attractive man. Max was imposing, balding, and his face was speckled with deep acne scars. He was wearing a spicy, old-fashioned men's cologne, the kind my father used to wear, and his office was similarly traditional and had the reassuring smell of leather furniture, wood, books. It couldn't be more different from the world inhabited by Gabriel, a world of colour and beauty for beauty's sake. He and Max were obviously nothing alike. A framed photograph of Gabriel was on the desk, a candid shot, possibly taken by Max. Gabriel was sitting on a fence in a country field, his hair blowing in the breeze, a camera slung around his neck. He looked more like an actor than a photographer, or an actor playing a photographer. Max caught me looking at the picture and nodded as if reading my mind.
"My brother got the hair and the looks, I got the brains,"
he laughed. "I'm joking. Actually, I was adopted. We weren't blood related."
"I didn't know that. Were you both adopted?"
"No, just me. Our parents thought they couldn't have children, but after they adopted me, they conceived a child of their own soon after. It's quite common, apparently, something to do with relieving stress."
"Were you and Gabriel close?"
"Closer than most, though he took center stage, of course. I was rather overshadowed by him."
"Why was that?"
"Well, It was difficult not to be. Gabriel was special, even as a child. Max had a habit of playing with his wedding ring. He kept turning it around his finger as he talked. Gabriel used to carry his camera everywhere, you know, taking pictures. My father thought he was mad. Turns out he was a bit of a genius, my brother. Do you know his work? I smiled diplomatically. I had no desire to get into a discussion of Gabriel's merits as a photographer. Instead, I steered the conversation back to Alicia. You must have known her quite well. Alicia? Must I? Something in Max changed at the mention of her name. His warmth evaporated. His tone was cold. I don't know if I can help you, he went on. I didn't represent Alicia in court. I can put you in touch with my colleague, Patrick Doherty, if you want details about the trial. That's not the kind of information I'm after. No? He gave me a curious look. As a psychotherapist, it can't be common practice to meet your patient's solicitor. Not if my patient can speak for herself, no. Max seemed to mull this over. I see. Well, as I said, I don't know how I can help, so I just have a couple of questions. Very well. Fire away. I remember reading in the press at the time that you saw Gabriel and Alicia the night before the murder. Yes, we had dinner together. How did they seem? Max's eyes glazed over. Presumably he'd been asked this question hundreds of times and his response was automatic, without thinking. Normal, totally normal. And Alicia? Normal, he shrugged. Maybe a bit more jumpy than usual, but... But... Nothing. I sensed there was more. I waited, and after a moment, Max went on. I don't know how much you know about their relationship. Only what I read in the papers. And what did you read? That they were happy. Happy? Max smiled coldly. Oh, they were happy. Gabriel did everything he could to make her happy. I see. But I didn't see. I didn't know where he was going. I must have looked puzzled because he shrugged and said, I'm not going to elaborate. If it's gossip you're after, talk to Jean-Félix, not me. Jean-Félix? Jean-Félix Martin. Alicia's gallerist? They'd known each other for years, as thick as thieves. Never liked him much, if I'm honest. I'm not interested in gossip, I said, making a mental note to talk to Jean-Félix as soon as possible. I'm more interested in your personal opinion. May I ask you a direct question? I thought you just did. Did you like Alicia? Max looked at me expressionlessly as he spoke. Of course I did. I didn't believe him. I sense you're wearing two different hats. The solicitor's hat, which is understandably discreet, and the brother's hat. It's the brother I came to see. There was a pause. I wondered if Max were going to ask me to leave. He seemed about to say something but changed his mind. Then he suddenly left the desk and went to the window. He opened it. There was a blast of cold air. Max breathed in deeply as if the room had been stifling him. Finally, he spoke in a low voice. The truth is, I hated her. I loathed her. I didn't say anything. I waited for him to go on. He kept looking out of the window. He spoke slowly. Gabriel wasn't just my brother. He was my best friend. He was the kindest man you ever met. Too kind. And all his talent, his goodness, his passion for life, wiped out because of that bitch. It wasn't just his life she destroyed, it was mine too. Thank God my parents didn't live to see it. He choked up, suddenly emotional. It was hard not to sense Max's pain, and I felt sorry for him. It must have been extremely difficult for you to organize Alicia's defense, I said. Max shut the window and returned to his desk. He had regained control of himself. He was wearing the solicitor's hat again, neutral, balanced, emotionless. He shrugged. It's what Gabriel would have wanted. He wanted the best for Alicia, always. He was mad about her. She was just mad. You think she was insane? You tell me, you're her shrink. What do you think?
I know what I observed.
And what was that?
Mood swings, rages, violent fits. She'd break things, smash stuff up. Gabriel told me she threatened to murder him on several occasions. I should have listened, done something.
After she tried to kill herself, I should have intervened, insisted she got some help, but I didn't. Gabriel was determined to protect her, and like an idiot, I let him. He sighed and checked his watch, a cue for me to wrap up the conversation, but I just stared at him blankly.
Alicia tried to kill herself. What do you mean? When? You mean after the murder?
Max shook his head.
No, several years before that. You don't know? I assumed you knew.
When was this?
After her father died, she took an overdose, pills or something, I can't remember exactly. She had a kind of breakdown.
I was about to press him further when the door opened. The receptionist appeared and spoke in a sniffly voice.
Darling, we should go, we'll be late.
Right, Max said. Coming, dear.
The door shut. Max stood up, giving me an apologetic glance. We have theatre tickets. I must have looked startled because he laughed.
We... Tanya and I were married last year.
Oh, I see. Gabriel's death brought us together. I couldn't have got through it without her. Max's phone rang, distracting him. I nodded at him to take the call. Thank you, you've been a great help, I said. I slipped out of the office. I took a closer look at Tanya in the reception. She was blonde, pretty, rather petite. She blew her nose and I noticed the large diamond on her wedding finger. To my surprise, she got up and walked towards me, frowning. She spoke urgently in a low voice.
If you want to know about Alicia, she said, talk to her cousin, Paul. He knows her better than anyone.
I tried calling her aunt, Lydia Rose, I said. She wasn't particularly forthcoming.
Forget Lydia. Go to Cambridge, talk to Paul. Ask him about Alicia and the night after the accident and...
The office door opened. Tanya immediately fell silent. Max emerged and she hurried over to him, smiling broadly.
Ready, darling? She asked.
Tanya was smiling, but she sounded nervous. She's afraid of Max, I thought. I wondered why.
Chapter 13. Alicia Berenson's Diary. 22nd of July. I hate the fact there's a gun in the house. We had another argument about it last night. At least, I thought that's what we were fighting about. I'm not so sure now. Gabriel said it was my fault we argued. I suppose it was. I hated seeing him so upset, looking at me with hurt eyes. I hate causing him pain, and yet sometimes I desperately want to hurt him, and I don't know why. He said I came home in a horrible mood. That I marched upstairs and started screaming at him. Perhaps I did. I suppose I was upset. I'm not altogether sure what happened. I had just got back from the heath. I don't remember much of the walk. I was daydreaming, thinking about work, about the Jesus picture. I remember walking past a house on my way home. Two boys were playing with a hose pipe. They couldn't have been older than 7 or 8. The older boy was spraying the younger with a jet of water, a rainbow of colour sparkling in the light. A perfect rainbow. The younger boy stretched out his hands, laughing. I walked past and I realised my cheeks were wet with tears. I dismissed it then, but thinking about it now, it seems obvious. I don't want to admit the truth to myself, that a huge part of my life is missing. That I've denied I want children, pretending I have no interest in them, that all I care about is my art, and it's not true. It's just an excuse. The truth is, I'm scared to have kids. I am not to be trusted with them. Not with my mother's blood running through my veins. That's what was on my mind, consciously or unconsciously, when I got home. Gabriel was right. I was in a bad state. But I never would have exploded if I hadn't found him cleaning the gun. It upsets me so much that he has it. And it hurts me he won't get rid of it, no matter how many times I beg him. He always says the same thing, that it was one of his father's old rifles from their farm, and he gave it to him when he was 16, that it has sentimental value, and blah, blah, blah. I don't believe him. I think there's another reason he's keeping it. I said so, and Gabriel said there was nothing wrong with wanting to be safe, wanting to protect his house and wife. What if someone broke in? Then we call the police, I said. We don't fucking shoot them. I had raised my voice, but he raised his louder, and before I knew it, we were yelling at each other. Maybe I was a bit out of control. But I was only reacting to him. There's an aggressive side to Gabriel. A part of him I only glimpse occasionally, and when I do, it scares me. For those brief moments, it's like living with a stranger. And that's terrifying. We didn't speak for the rest of the evening. We went to bed in silence. This morning we had sex and made up. We always seem to resolve our problems in bed. It's easier somehow when you're naked and half asleep under the covers to whisper, I'm sorry, and mean it. All defences and bullshit justifications are discarded, lying in a heap on the floor, with our clothes. Maybe we should make it a rule to always conduct arguments in bed. He kissed me. I love you. I'll get rid of the rifle, I promise. No, I said. It doesn't matter. Forget it. It's okay. Really. Gabriel kissed me again and pulled me close. I held on to him, laying my naked body on his. I closed my eyes and stretched out on a friendly rock that was moulded to my shape. And I felt at peace, at last. 23rd of July. I'm writing this in Café de l'Artiste. I come here most days now. I keep feeling the need to get out of the house. When I'm around other people, even if it's only the bored waitress in here, I feel connected to the world somehow, like a human being. Otherwise, I'm in danger of ceasing to exist, like I might disappear. Sometimes I wish I could disappear, like tonight. Gabriel has invited his brother over for dinner. He sprung it on me this morning. We've not seen Max in ages, he said. Not since Joel's housewarming. I'll do a barbecue. Gabriel looked at me strangely. You don't mind, do you? Why would I mind? Gabriel laughed. You're such a bad liar, you know that. I can read your face like a very short book. And what does it say? That you don't like Max. You never have. That's not true. I could feel myself going red. I shrugged and looked away. Of course I like Max, I said. It'll be nice to see him. When are you going to sit for me again? I need to finish the picture. Gabriel smiled. How about this weekend? And about the painting, do me a favor. Don't show Max, all right? I don't want him to see me as Jesus. I'll never live it down. Max won't see it, I said. It's not ready yet. And even if it were, Max is the last person I want in my studio. I thought that, but didn't say it. I'm dreading going home now. I want to stay here, in this air-conditioned cafe, and hide until Max has left. But the waitress is already making little impatient noises and emphatically checking her watch. I'll be kicked out soon. And that means short of wandering the streets all night like a mad person, I have no choice but to go home and face the music. And face Max. 24th of July. I'm back in the cafe. Someone was sitting at my table and the waitress gave me a sympathetic look. At least I think that's what she was communicating. A sense of solidarity, but I could be wrong. I took another table, facing in, not out, by the air conditioning unit. There's not much light. It's cold and dark, which suits my mood. Last night was awful. Worse than I thought it would be. I didn't recognise Max when he arrived. I don't think I've ever seen him out of a suit before. He looked a bit silly in shorts. He was sweating profusely after the walk from the station. His bald head was red and shiny and dark patches were spreading out from under his armpits. He wouldn't meet my eye at first. Or was it me not looking at him? He made a big thing of the house, saying how different it looked. How long it was since we'd invited him, that he was starting to think we'd never ask again. Gabriel kept apologising, saying how busy we'd been, me with the upcoming exhibition and him with work, and we'd not seen anyone. Gabriel was smiling, but I could tell he felt annoyed that Max had made such a point of it. I kept up a pretty good front at first. I was waiting for the right moment, and then I found it. Max and Gabriel went into the garden and got the barbecue going. I hung around in the kitchen on the pretext of making a salad. I knew Max would make an excuse to come and find me. And I was right. After about 5 minutes, I heard his heavy, thudding footsteps. He doesn't walk at all like Gabriel. Gabriel is so silent. He's like a cat. I never hear him moving around the house at all. Alicia, Max said. I realized my hands were shaking as I chopped the tomatoes. I put down the knife. I turned round to face him. Max held up his empty beer bottle and smiled. He still wouldn't look at me. I've come for another, he said. I nodded. I didn't say anything. He opened the fridge and took out another beer. He looked around for the opener. I pointed at it, on the counter. He gave me a funny smile as he opened the beer, like he was going to say something, but I beat him to it. I'm going to tell Gabriel what happened, I said. I thought you should know. Max stopped smiling. He looked at me for the first time, with snake-like eyes. What? I'm telling Gabriel about what happened at Joel's. I don't know what you're talking about. Don't you? I don't remember. I was rather drunk, I'm afraid. Bullshit. It's true. You don't remember kissing me. You don't remember grabbing me. Alicia, don't. Don't what? Make a big deal out of it. You assaulted me. I could feel myself getting angry. It was an effort to control my voice and not start shouting. I glanced out of the window. Gabriel was at the end of the garden, standing over the barbecue. The smoke and the hot air distorted my view of him, and he was all bent out of shape. He looks up to you, I said. You're his older brother. He's going to be so hurt when I tell him. Then don't. There's nothing to tell him. He needs to know the truth. He needs to know what his brother is really like. You... Before I could finish, Max grabbed my arm hard and pulled me towards him. I lost my balance and fell onto him. He raised his fist and I thought he was going to punch me. I love you, he said. I love you, I love you, I love... Before I could react, he kissed me. I tried to pull away, but he wouldn't let me. I felt his rough lips all over mine and his tongue pushing its way into my mouth. Instinct took over. I bit his tongue as hard as I could. Max cried out and shoved me away. When he looked up, his mouth was full of blood. Fucking bitch! His voice was garbled, his teeth red. He glared at me like a wounded animal. I can't believe Max is Gabriel's brother. He has none of Gabriel's fine qualities, none of his decency, none of his kindness. Max disgusts me, and I said so. Alicia. Don't say anything to Gabriel, he said. I mean it. I'm warning you. I didn't say another word. I could taste his blood on my tongue, so I turned on the tap and rinsed my mouth until it was gone. Then I walked out into the garden. Occasionally, I sensed Max staring at me over dinner. I'd look up and catch his eye, and he'd look away. I didn't eat anything. The thought of eating made me sick. I kept tasting his blood in my mouth. I don't know what to do. I don't want to lie to Gabriel. Nor do I want to keep it a secret, but if I tell Gabriel, he'll never speak to Max again. It would devastate him to know he'd misplaced his trust in his brother, because he does trust Max. He idolizes him. And he shouldn't. I don't believe Max is in love with me. I believe he hates Gabriel, that's all. I think he's madly jealous of him, and he wants to take everything that belongs to Gabriel, which includes me. But now I've stood up to him, I don't think he'll bother me again. At least I hope not. Not for a while, anyway. So for the moment, I'm going to remain silent. Of course, Gabriel can read me like a book. Or maybe I'm just not a very good actress. Last night, as we were getting ready for bed, he said I'd been weird the whole time Max was there. I was just tired. No, it was more than that. You were so distant. You might have made more of an effort. We barely ever see him. I don't know why you have such a problem with him. I don't. It was nothing to do with Max. I was distracted. I was thinking about work. I'm behind with the exhibition. It's all I can think about. I said this with as much conviction as I could muster. Gabriel gave me a disbelieving look, but he let it go, for the moment. I'll have to face it again next time we see Max. but something tells me that won't be for a while. I feel better for having written this down. I feel safer, somehow, having it on paper. It means I have some evidence, some proof, if it ever comes to that. 26th of July. It's my birthday today. I'm 33 years old. It's strange. It's older than I ever saw myself as being. My imagination only ever extended this far. I've outlived my mother now. It's an unsteady feeling being older than she was. She got to 32, and then she stopped. Now I've outlived her and won't stop. I will grow older and older, but she won't. Gabriel was so sweet this morning. He kissed me awake and presented me with 33 red roses. They were beautiful. He pricked his finger on one of the thorns, a blood-red teardrop. It was perfect. Then he took me for a picnic on the heath for breakfast. The sun was barely up, so the heat wasn't unbearable. There was a cool breeze coming off the water, and the air smelled of cut grass. We lay by the pond under a weeping willow, on the blue blanket we bought in Mexico. The willow branches formed a canopy over us, and the sun burned hazily through the leaves. We drank champagne and ate small sweet tomatoes with smoked salmon and slivers of bread. Somewhere in the back of my mind, there was a vague feeling of familiarity, a nagging sense of déjà vu I couldn't quite place. Perhaps it was simply a recollection of childhood stories, fairy tales, and magical trees being gateways to other worlds. Perhaps it was something more prosaic. And then the memory came back to me. I saw myself when very young, sitting under the branches of the willow tree in our garden in Cambridge. I'd spend hours hiding there. I may not have been a happy child, but during the time I spent under the willow tree, I felt a similar contentment to lying here with Gabriel. And now it was as if the past and the present were coexisting in one perfect moment. I wanted that moment to last forever. Gabriel fell asleep and I sketched him, trying to capture the dappled sunlight on his face. I did a better job with his eyes this time. It was easier because they were closed, but at least I got their shape right. He looked like a little boy, curled up asleep and breathing gently, crumbs around his mouth. We finished the picnic, went home and had sex, and Gabriel held me in his arms and said something astonishing.
Alicia, darling, listen. There's something on my mind I want to talk to you about.
The way he said it made me instantly nervous. I braced myself, fearing the worst. Go on. I want us to have a baby. It took me a moment to speak. I was so taken aback, I didn't know what to say. But you didn't want any children, you said.
Forget that. I changed my mind. I want us to have a child together. Well, what do you say?
Gabriel looked at me hopefully, expectantly, waiting for my response. I felt my eyes welling up with tears. Yes, I said. Yes, yes, yes. We hugged each other and cried and laughed. He's in bed now, asleep. I had to sneak away and write all this down. I want to remember this day for the rest of my life, every single second of it. I feel joyous. I feel full of hope.